You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
We welcome Marcus Buckingham back to the podcast. For over 25 years, Marcus has been the world's leading researcher on strengths, engagement, and human performance. He began his career at Gallup and was the co-creator with Donald O. Clifton of StrengthsFinder. He is a best-selling author who has a brand new book. It's called Design Love In, How to Unleash the Most Powerful Force in Business. You will love this podcast. Marcus Buckingham, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you for having me, Kelly.
This could be my favorite Marcus Buckingham book. I think it is. And it's in part because it has so much to offer at the end as it does in the beginning, which is actually rare for most books. So in that spirit, I want to start our conversation with the epilogue, where you write about what happened about a year ago at the U.S. State Department. The date was Friday, July 12th, 2025. What happened that day? Why did it end up in your book?
Yeah, so as part of the DOGE restructuring, the State Department had laid off thousands of workers as part of their, I guess, cost-cutting measures. And that's normal, sadly, in today's world. We live in a capitalistic society where there are sometimes you've overhired and sometimes there are cost pressures and sometimes people do have to be furloughed or laid off. I mean, that's the reality. But what was remarkable, I thought anyway about it, was what happened as those people had packed up their boxes and schlepped them down the corridors and across the main lobby of the State Department building and out with their belongings to their cars. The existing employees all lined the corridors and just broke out into spontaneous clapping and applause. And it wasn't really a stand of defiance. At least my interpretation of it wasn't. It was more like a recognition that we will not let our fellow colleagues be just turned into disposable rounding errors. These are humans. They are worth seeing and honoring. And as they get walked out in the sort of furlough walk of shame, there is no shame. These are humans now. There were humans before. There were humans afterwards. We see you. And it was this spontaneous, like, we will not stand by in a world that reduces humans in their endeavors at work into disposable elements of financial transactions. We won't. They can be seen that way. The DOGE folks are clearly seeing them that way. But we, your colleagues, we will stand and notice you as humans. And I just thought it was a lovely a manifestation of the connection between all of us humans and kind of a repudiation of a world that's becoming increasingly disconnected and loveless. So that's why I ended the book that way.
Yeah, it reminded me a bit of during COVID when in places like New York, you would see people coming back from, you know, caregivers and hospital people. So people started hitting pots and pans outside their windows. This is in New York. Right, where you don't feel anyone is necessarily connected in that way. And so sometimes, thank God, it is some of these really dire, terrible moments where people can stand up and show that we're better than that.
Yes. And it's, you know, as I say in the book, there's a number of mind moves that I encourage the reader to step into in the book. And one of them is the mindset is you get more of what you expect. And the mind move is you get more of what you accept. And treating other humans lovelessly as disposable elements of a transaction from whom we need to extract as much value is becoming increasingly acceptable. It's just we're accepting of it. And this, the State Department, was a refusal to accept that. And they stood up for their fellow human and said, it's not acceptable for us not to look at you in the eye and thank you, see you, recognize you. And we won't allow ourselves to slide or slouch toward a working world or a world where we don't see each other. We won't let that happen. So it was like, aha, this is not acceptable. And I thought that was just really cool.
So the thing you're fighting against, you know, that you were in this meeting in New York with chief human resource officers, these are the largest companies in the world, and you present your data on love, and they couldn't even say the word?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. When you look at the data, you're clearly, as a leader, you're trying to change behavior for the better.
Yeah.
You're trying to change behavior of customers, you're trying to change behavior of employees. And there's two ways to do that. Either you can do it directively, which means for employees, you set goals and give feedback and so forth. And with customers, you set prices and have loyalty programs and specials. And you can change behavior somewhat in those ways. But we know that that is temporary. That if you really want to sustainably change behavior, you've got to follow the logic of experiences drive behaviors, drive outcomes. So if you want to drive better outcomes, well, you've got to go upstream, change behaviors. How do you change behaviors? Well, you've got to change the experiences. The experiences you create for customers and employees, change the behaviors, change the outcomes. Well, if you then unpack that and go, well, what kind of experiences sustainably drive productive behaviors and really great outcomes? Well, if you unpack that, when you really look at what are extreme positive human experiences, the word that you come across again and again and again and again, customers and colleagues, is love. People go, I love that brand. I love those shoes. I love that movie. I love that mentor. I loved working on that team. I loved wearing that outfit. I loved that teacher. So it's big things and small things, but whenever we humans are trying to reach for a word that captures an extreme positive human experience, the word we use is love. So I was showing them this data going, hey guys, mea culpa, I kept changing the word love. Even though you hear it in interviews and focus groups ad infinitum, I kept changing it to something more palatable to the business community, like joy or passion or engagement or strengths, even sure. Satisfaction, all good words. But I was sharing with these top CHROs, the word people actually use is love.
Yeah.
And so we ought to take it seriously. If we want the most, put the moral issues aside, let's just put our business hats on. If we want sustainable productivity, if we want outcomes like retention or loyalty or advocacy, we better take seriously the antecedent to those things, which is experiences people say that they love. And I had like lots of data on quote unquote, the business case for love, but they, even after seeing it, and these are human resource. These weren't engineers or something.
Yeah, right. Or CEOs even.
Or CEOs,
or CMOs. Yeah.
They couldn't say the word. Initially, they pushed back across both customers and employees. Eventually, they came to go, well, I get it with our customers. We want our customers to love our brand. And we're comfortable with that word vis-a-vis our customers and their relationship with our company. But even after 2 hours, they never got to the place where they could go, no, but not our people. I mean, we want the discretionary effort of our people, but we don't want them to love us. And I think that the reason why, Kelly, is because of the State Department thing. Because it's like, hey, at some point, we're going to probably, I don't know, we may have to kick them out. And besides which, we might want to protect ourselves from our employees. You know, HR's got a weird relationship to their mission. Some part of it is developmental for humans, and some part of it is protection of the company from the people. So it was weird that they couldn't, they weren't allowing themselves to go, let's be curious about the most powerful driver of productive human behavior, which is love. Strange.
So the current Second City show, we just opened a new show. It's called Pandemonium, Please Hold. And there is a song like early in the show. And it's a little girl and she's at the playground with her dad talking about the dreams that she has. And her dream, as she starts to sing the song, is increasing shareholder value. And then uses every buzzword you could possibly use. And it's such a great satiric piece because everyone in the audience has like been in these meetings and known the stuff. And I want to ask, I'm going to ask you to go on a little journey with me, because we had Joe Pine on the podcast maybe like nine weeks ago. And he coined the term the experience economy, which you reference in the book. Yep. And his new book is called The Transformation Economy. And one of the things that I am an advocate for in my world of improvisation, which is actually not something that a ton of people talk about, which is the key to really great improvisation and great theater is transformation. It is this idea of like, you're doing the scene, it's hilarious, but then something changes in the person, the scene, in you as an audience member, that is awesome. That is amazing. That it might be love related. And of course, Joe is into improvisation. So he was like willing to go with me on this. And as I'm reading your book, I'm like, oh yeah, we're all talking about kind of the same thing, which is when people come to Second City, yeah, they come here to be laughed, but they come here to be moved. Mm. And how are they moved? And how are they reminded what's important? And that song that this little girl does, what she's saying is like, yeah, all the things she's saying, the joke is we shouldn't be thinking about a shareholder value.
Right.
And instead, what we want to be thinking about is like, how do I wake up and how am I happy coming to work? And, you know, how am I satisfied? How do I flourish?
Mm.
You know, and that means that you're going to have to talk about things like love.
Well, people do talk about things like love. That's kind of where I came through. It's like, hey, listen, wake up. They are saying that. Don't change the word, Marcus. They are saying, I love this, I love that, I love this, I love that. And love doesn't mean kissing in front of the Eiffel Tower, right? It means whenever you've got some sort of experience which is extreme positive, you use the word love. So the book was really trying to dive into, look, let's take that seriously as a driver of super productive human behavior. Not just as a feeling, but as a force, right? So what do they mean by it? And when you push on it, as you said, I mean, yes, there's 8 billion definitions of the word love. I totally get it. But if around the world it drives productive human behavior, if we can predict what someone's going to do next when they say, I love that, which we can around the world, there must be something common about our understanding of the meaning of that word. And when I pushed and pushed and pushed on that and tried to code to like, what is the common understanding? The word that I landed on is the word you just used. It's this sort of unwavering commitment to the flourishing of a human. And and if you push on, well, what do we mean by flourish? We mean the feeling of becoming more fully yourself over time, the feeling of being, of opening up over time. So the image that I have in my head, Kelly, is like that little girl, right? She's got something inside of herself that she can't even articulate, but she knows it's unique and distinct, even from her brothers and her sisters, and it's in there. Mm-hmm. And she wants to get to 95 years old on the porch and not look back and go, it's still in there. Mm-hmm. Instead, she wants to look back and go, I had a chance, whatever success I may or may not have had, financially or otherwise, I got a chance to express some of that uniqueness inside of me. Every human knows that feeling. And yet we go through the world kind of rolled up like an armadillo with armor plating around us, and because the world's scary. And so whenever we bump into any experience, no matter how trivial, like I love that song, or I love that time when I went to Second City, I love the experience I had, or I love that mentor, whatever it is. We're using the word love when we've got a chance through the experience we've just had to take off a plate of armor and express something in us. So I love those shoes because when I wear them, I just feel a little bit more like myself. I love that teacher, even though they're really tough on me, because they reached through my grades and set me up to learn more than I've ever learned before from that one teacher. So I got to take off little plates of armor and express myself. So love is that. Love is feeling more fully yourself over time. And any experience, small or large, that lets us do that, the word we attach to that is love. So love doesn't describe the size of the impact of an experience. It describes the intimacy of that experience. And the reason why that song that you were just describing probably is hysterical is because the incongruity of that's not in her. Those things aren't in her. That's not what she yearns for. It's all of this soulless set of metrics out there when in fact, what that little girl wants is what we all want. We want a chance to move into experiences that make us a little bigger than we were before, Now, whether you call that transformation, whether you call that expression, whether you call it love, we want experiences that make us a little bigger than we were before, whether it's a song or a movie or a dress or a mentor or a meeting. That's love. And when we have experiences like that, we call them loving. So the whole point of the book was to go, hey, we can design that in, or we could totally become disfluent in it, pretend that love is this flattened cliche of rubbish, and begin to create, as we're doing now, increasingly loveless experiences at work and at home. And the book was like, no, that's not okay. It's bad business and it's amoral.
Yeah. And I think you do a smart thing up front, which is let's talk about some unloving acts in business, because I think for someone who maybe is a bit cynical, they're like, totally get it. So one of those you talk about are handoffs. Mm-hmm. And our customer, like, if you don't know what I mean by handoff, I'm going to let you describe it, because we all hate it.
Well, it's funny. I thought the pushback on the word would have been the word love for this book, right?
Yeah.
And certainly those CHROs couldn't say it. But the whole focus of the book is on this competency, which I call experience intelligence. Mm-hmm. I love Joe Pyne's book, and I love the idea of an experience economy. This is just more narrowly focused on, no, this is a leadership capability. You can design experiences. And experiences, of course, have a before, a during, and an after. You go through an experience as a human. So one of the examples I used in the book was going to a Coldplay concert. Well, when you go to a Coldplay concert, there's the buying of the ticket. There's the driving to the stadium. There's the buying of stuff at the convenience stores or the concession stands. Then there's the concert itself. Then there's the getting out of the concert. Then there's the leave. We are moving through an experience as a human. Most of our experiences in the world, though, have not been designed that way. They've been designed as vertical silos, and you're handed off from one vertical silo to another. And you, the human, feel this when you call up your bank and you're handed off from one robo, customer service rep to another one, to another one, to another department. In human resources, if you work for a company, you don't have an integrated experience. If you have a pay question, you get handed off here. If you got a family leave question, you get handed off to a totally different department who probably doesn't even work for the company. If you've got an issue that relates to employee relations, it's another. So you're just handed off from one place to another to another. And of course, what that does is it means that you, the person, have to knit together the coherence of your narrative as you try to explain yourself from one person off to another to another to another. The most extreme example of this handoff world that we've made is healthcare, where the patient has to be the one. They're handed off from one nurse to a second nurse to another physician to a different physician to a different nurse to a different nurse practitioner. And the patient has to be the one to remember all the details, put them together into coherent narrative, remember which ones are important and which aren't, figure out how to continue to explain yourself as you move from one person to another. Well, that's massively stressful and probably accounts for the reason why we spend so much money on healthcare and have such comparatively bad patient outcomes. We have built a coherently stressful handoff situation for the patient. A more micro example, or sort of frequent example for us humans, is going to a restaurant, where we've built our restaurants as though the person who you make the reservation with isn't the person who walks you to the table. The person who walks you to the table is not the person you can order a drink from. The person you order a drink from is not the person who you can order food from. The person who brings your food is not the person you ordered it from. The whole thing has been designed for vertical efficiency. But in the middle is a guest, you, who's trying to hold the whole darn thing together. Schools, same thing. So we've built a world where we are lovelessly handed off from one person to another. And the person who's got to try to hold it all together as an experience is you. And one of the reasons why there's so much anxiety in the world, so much stress, is that humans don't function well when we are trying to knit together an experience through a bunch of disintegrated experiences. They used to have a general HR person who was your main guide to help you in your world of work. Well, the last 30 years, HR disintegrated itself. There's no HR generalist role anymore. There's none of that. You are all by yourself, and there are these vertical specialties, and best of British luck to you in navigating through it. So wherever we look, we live in this lovelessly handed off world, And it's bad business. It looks like it's good business. It's bad business because you destroy love. And when you destroy love, you destroy loyalty, advocacy, retention, all the good outcomes you want.
And this importance on the sequence was so interesting to me, because one of the things that people don't know necessarily about coming to a Second City show, right? So we have this seemingly unconnected series of scenes and songs and improvisation. It is not, it's very connected, and a thing called running order. So the key to our stuff is the order in which the material appears throughout the night, because we have learned, and this goes back to vaudeville and other things in terms of the people who created Second City who understood that, which is there is a place in the evening where you're going to put this particular piece, which might appear to be a bit offensive for people. So you're not going to put that early in the show where they might walk out. You know, you're going to put that in the second act where they've already sat down, and there's another place where you're going to put a song. And this is where you need to see everyone in the cast. And here's where you can just see two people having, you know, a conversation. And, you know, there's a flow and an ebb to it. And like a great album, you know, it's like that stuff. Mm. They didn't, Dark Side of the Moon was not like, well, let's just throw the tracks, you know, wherever. It's like, no. They did that very sequentially so that you could experience this. And that's why the Coldplay thing was interesting to me, especially with regard to the parking, which is, you know, rough. But we give this so much thought and care for what goes on our stage, because we know that that's so important. But I know for a fact that we, until, you know, fairly recently, we didn't give that much thought or care to the whole other experience of like, well, wait a sec, when someone is showing up here, what are they seeing? What are they touching? How are they moving through the space? And you have to think about all of that, whether you're a world famous comedy theater or whether you're a grocery store.
Well, that's the way. Once you, it's like the mind move is once you go experiences drive behavior, drive outcomes. Well, then you got to go, what the heck's an experience? Is it just a moment? Is it just the moments that delight? No, a moment jolts. Mm-hmm. A moment's a surprise. And the good ones are good and the bad ones are not so good. They don't change behavior. So don't hang your hat on moments. The difference between a moment and experience is an experience is a series of touch points that have become internalized in the person. And because they become internalized, they become a prediction device. If you have an experience designed of all these touch points, then I will go back to Second City, because the last time I went, I had this coherent set of touch point experiences, which I might not be able to even articulate, but sure, they've become this coherent thing where if I go back, I'm going to have the same experience again, because it was made of a multitude of touch points. That means an experience has to be designed. Mm-hmm. An undesigned experience leads to unpredictable outcomes. And we humans, if you don't design an experience, that doesn't mean we don't have an experience. It means it's an undesigned experience, which leads to things you might not want. The Coldplay example was, I mean, you know, if you buy concert tickets, that's part of the experience. The Ticketmaster gouginess of it all is part of the experience, mm-hmm, not necessarily a good part of the experience. Mm-mm. You go through the concert, and my Coldplay experience was the actual concert itself was choreographed to within an inch of its life. Chris Martin and the boys, they figured out the right, you know, the right sequence of songs, as you said, the right time to bring out the bracelets that all glowed yellow and the flags and then the firework. It was designed to perfection. And then we got out and we had to leave, right? And the last song was all about where we're all in this together. And it was this beautiful, warm, like, oh my word. And then no sooner had we left to get into our cars than we realized that it was a total disaster. No one had thought about the experience of leaving the facility. So it took almost as long to leave the facility as it did to watch the concert. And we were all fighting because there was no clear coherence about which lane we should be in and how you should go. Mm-hmm. There was no love. There was zero love applied to that part of the experience. Why? Because Chris Martin, God bless him, had drawn a line in his mind and said, well, I'm not responsible for that part of the experience. I'm going to outsource it. But of course, I, as a person coming to your concert, Chris, I haven't outsourced it. I'm getting in my darn car. So if we actually think lovingly about experiences, we've got to go through the before, the during, and the after, which, you know, for Second City, on some level, that's like, well, what's the during? What's act one? What's act two? What's act three? But there's also, how do they buy the tickets? How do they bump into that email? How do they get that notification? These are all touch points. They're all doing work. They're all doing work of some kind. Afterwards, how do you stay in touch with people? What do you say? How do you say? I'm sorry. It's all part of the experience that I'm putting together in my mind, which changes my behavior. It's not coincidental to me that some of the biggest acts, like, say, Taylor Swift, has gone, I'm going to take the whole ticket buying part away from the outsourced people that I gave it to before. Taylor Swift Ticks is the place that I'm going to have for people to go and get properly priced tickets for my shows. When you think holistically about an experience, those are the people that actually get the loyalty, get the retention, get all the good outcomes we want from people. Because if you can design an experience that's really thought about the sequence of the before, the during, and the after, has taken every touch point seriously, then we as humans, implicitly or explicitly, we lean into that and go, oh, wow, I'm in loving hands. And look, I love Coldplay, but Chris, like, I'm not saying you should be in the parking business, but you can't just draw a line in your mind, man.
Yeah.
Like, we will put up with it and your concert was really successful. But that's part of the problem, is that we've outsourced big chunks of experiences for employees and for customers. And it feels, I mean, for us humans, it just feels totally incoherent, which is unloving.
I won't go to corporate concerts anymore. I mean, I like Coldplay. I would love to see them. I won't. It's like, I don't fest anymore. Some people are like, you're going to go to Lollapalooza? I'm like, don't fest. It's not interesting for me. I live walking distance from the Old Town School of Folk Music. It's about a 400 seat venue. I saw Graham Nash play there recently. It was lovely. I can walk in. I literally walk home. It's pleasing to me. So one of the things I was thinking about and talking about with my colleagues here is the NBA. Right now, at any given time, I don't know where the game is. They are on so many different channels. Some are streaming. So I have all the streamers. So at least for me, like if it's Peacock or if it's Netflix or whatever it is, Prime, I can get there. But any given night, like, I have to go find it. And then sometimes it's lagging because of the stream. And I'm like, I know the NBA is popular. I can't help but feel that this, you know, idea of like, hey, it can be on any channel at any time is not going to hurt them in the long run, because it takes me out of the experience of that I want to have with, we're in the playoffs now. I should be able to like just go and jump in on this thing, and I can't.
Yeah, it's one of the things that I lay out in the book is if you imagine somebody going, I love the NBA, or I love that experience at that restaurant, or I love that show at Second City, and you reverse engineer it and you go, okay, how'd they get there? How do we get someone to go, I love that? Well, whatever the experience is, how do you get them to say, I love that? Well, if you reverse engineer that, it turns out there's a sequence of five feelings. It's not Maslow's hierarchy. There's a sequence of five feelings. And I put it in the book to go, hey, look, dear leader, if you want to get people to say, love that, five feelings are a blueprint. It's a blueprint. I don't know exactly what activations you're going to do to create each of these five feelings. That'll depend upon you and your business and your team and so forth. But these five feelings are common to all humans: control, harmony, significance, warmth of others, growth. And you can't start with growth. You've got to start with control. And what control doesn't mean control over someone else. If I'm having an experience, I want control over my own actions, choices. I need to understand what this world is. I need to understand what it stands for. I need to understand how it works. What tools am I going to be given? Do the tools do what they're supposed to do? All those things. When I get those in any experience, whether it's a toothpaste tube, or whether it's an NBA game, or whether it's a Second City concert, if you can give me clarity about what this is, how do I get into it, what is it for me, and how does it work, then I start to lean in. When I don't feel those things, I feel out of control, I feel powerless, what Martin Seligman called learned helplessness. Mm-hmm. We humans hate that. I lean out. So what you're describing, well, I can't flip and find the games. It's on different channels. Or the NBA, if you're not careful, what you've done is you've immediately put yourself in recovery. You've made every fan lean out emotionally because you haven't been coherent about how I experience the experience of the playoffs. You've disintegrated yourself. That's not neutral. It's, let's call it by what it is. It's unloving. You've done something unloving. You've tried to extract as much value as you possibly can from your games, which is fine, but you've destroyed the loyalty of the viewer. Okay. That's unintelligent. In terms of experience, intelligence, that's low IQ. So it's sort of one part of writing the book was to go, let's call things what they are. When what you're describing, Kelly, is low experience intelligence. And you go to all the big business schools, it's the strangest thing. No one teaches this.
Mm-mm.
No one teaches that what you're talking about. Here's the sequence of five feelings. A strategy is the intentional design of experiences that address those feelings. If you don't know what the feelings are, if you don't know how to design to create those feelings in people, please don't say you have a strategy. You've got an extraction device. Well, that's okay, but you're not actually building a world in which more and more and more customers go, I love the NBA. You're not doing that. You should be doing that for moral and business reasons. So yeah, the whole point of the book was to go that there's an intentional sequence to this. You can design for it. And when you're not designing for it, let's call it what it is. It's unloving, which means it's bad business. Not necessarily tomorrow. You can get away with being unloving for a short time. But over time, it means you have fewer and fewer viewers going, I love the NBA.
Yeah. So let's give an example of a company that does this well, which is Disney, which is and I what I didn't realize until reading your book was that Disney actually created a VP of parking.
Yes. So Disney, they don't always, you know, every company is made up of a million different touch points, right? So they don't always do it perfectly. And you might say, well, of course Disney does it perfect, but there's people in their space, the entertainment and theme park space, who don't do it very well at all. They've taken a very deliberate, I mean, the person I interviewed at the beginning of the book was Josh D'Amaro, who now is the CEO of the whole Disney company. At the time when I was interviewing him and following him around and just trying to figure out why he had this reputation of being such a great leader, he was in charge of the parks, the resorts, the consumer products, and the cruise lines and Imagineering, which he had, interestingly, renamed as Disney Experiences. I mean, if there's a leader who knows, you know, the color of that trash can, the location of that trash can vis-a-vis all the other trash cans is worthy of my time. How do we redesign the Millennium Falcon ride? Because right now we've got people getting off the ride and giving it a 4 out of 5. And I don't want that. I need 5. So I need people to come off the ride and go, I love that. Well, I've got a lot. And I'm going to spend 4 or 5 hours going, why the 4s? Now, so he does weird. I mean, he pays attention to weird details. One of the weird details that he pays attention to, Disney pays attention to, is the parking. Why? Because there's a before, there's a during, and there's an after to the experience of going to the park. And part of the after is I got to drive out of there. Well, there's an awful lot of people who park their car and either can't find it, or they get lost in the parking lots because they're so big, or they leave their lights on. And so why wouldn't we think about how to make sure that if you have found a person who's left their lights on, we are arriving with you when you come back to be able to recharge your battery so that you can get out of the parking lot. Why wouldn't we think through that? Why wouldn't we take the penultimate part of your experience of Disney as importantly as we did when you bought the day pass? Or whatever pass you have, we should. Why? Because we are an experience company. I mean, I think Joe Piner would agree that sort of every company is an experience company.
Yeah,
you buy toothpaste, that's an experience. The rolling up of the tube, how much of it you can get out, how it stands in your shower, how messy the top is, on all of that is part of an experience that's either lovingly designed or undesigned. And so for Disney, the VP of parking is the same mindset that turns a line into part of the experience. I think Disney does this incredibly well, or tries to. How do we make the line part of the show? How do we make the line at the Tower of Terror so that at each corner you turn, there's something, some little Easter egg or nugget that the Imagineers have put up there to up your ante in terms of your fear? which of course is what you want to feel because that's why you got on the darn ride. But they're very, like, experience design, loving experience design is a skill. Yeah. Like, you can actually apply that skill to anybody who's in any sort of leadership or experience making role. And so for Disney, what's interesting about them is they really take this skill incredibly seriously, even to the point of coming up with a VP of parking, because that person's got to think very carefully about the experience that that guest is going to have. Why? Because the guest's going to have the experience anyway. So we might as well design for it. It's curious.
The joke we had here is while maybe we don't need a VP of parking because we're close to an L stop and some other stuff, is we certainly need a VP of bathrooms. Because when people are drinking and they can't find a bathroom or they don't know where to go or whatever, that has always become a thing. And you just have to know for your business. And Monday night, I was at the Economic Club of Chicago, and they were interviewing the CEO of Costco. So Costco has only had three CEOs in the history of Costco. And the guy who is the CEO now has been with the company 44 years, and he started as a forklift driver. And this guy, like, talk about someone who understood the culture of their company. And I am someone who has never been in a Costco. Like, I just haven't. That's not my world. Wow. I was sort of blown away by his knowledge. And this is at Costco. I mean, like, you can buy diamonds as well as your hot dog, as well as get a hot dog. I mean, it is like, it's a world. And the warmth in that room. And the way, when I came out of this thing, I started talking to people, their response to their experience with Costco, that is a loved brand. I don't know if you've ever, I don't know if you've done any research on them or experienced them, but wow, just from my POV, you know, people like, that's the way they talk about it. They love Costco.
Well, yeah, no, I have. They are, what they seem to realize more than so many, I'll say grocery stores, but they're way bigger than that, of course.
Yeah.
Is, like one of the books, one of the companies that I read about in the book is Kroger.
Yeah.
Kroger is in some ways a competitor of theirs. And Kroger is so different than Costco. I mean, Barney Kroger, who first started Kroger, was all about the quality of the artisans who make the bread, which is or the tea, back in the 1850s and 60s. Maybe it was the 70s, 1870s. And the local community that you serve. He was all about that. And you can still see some parts of that, even with Costco. It's just Costco. With Kroger, they've bought these other brands and then kept the name of the brand. So King Soopers or Dillon's or Ralph's. And there's some echo of Barney Kroger focusing on the local community that lives on in these unique brands. But if you're not careful, if you're Kroger, and they have, 2,700 locations, 450,000 people, if you're not careful, you lose sight of what I think Costco hasn't ever lost sight of, which is that the environment of a Costco is a stage. Yes. You are putting on a play. And the play has, like, you can't put on five plays. Mm-hmm. You have one play, which means visually there should be no visual pollution. Everything should be, and at a Costco, you go into a Costco, they know exactly who they're trying to be. Those aisles are incredibly well lit, but they're full of surprises. You go one aisle one day and it's one thing. You come back 2 days later, it's an entirely, and you might go, well, that gives people no control, going back to those five feelings. But actually, you know that Costco has surprises in it.
Yep.
Surprises in terms of prices, surprises in terms of items. Who knows what you're going to be shown to sample? They have crazy, wonderful sampling things that where people know the job of the sampler. They're not trying to sell their item. I mean, they kind of are, but they're trying to surprise you with something weird and wonderful in aisle 16. Well, Kroger, if they're not careful, they think that they've got 2,700 factories, not stages, factories. And the job of the people who work there is to put stuff on shelves. And then somehow, goodness knows how, the stuff jumps off the shelves overnight and they got to put more stuff on the shelves the next day. If that's how you think of a Kroger store, then you start to lose sight of the fact that there's an audience walking into, there's 22 million people in the audience every day who walk in and try to make sense of the play you're putting on. Well, if you've lost sight of them, you're not putting on a play anymore. You just put anything on stage. And to use, you know, your vernacular, you've got props from a previous play. And then you've got signs that really the performers should be seeing, but actually the audience can now see them. And it's not deliberate. It's just a mess. And then you're trying to say something to the audience, but there's a bunch of other people on the stage saying a bunch of other stuff because there's warring playwrights, if you like, putting on play. It's like Costco has one singular play it's putting on. And it doesn't try to do anything else beyond that particular sort of play. And you can see it in the layout, the lighting, the smell, the sounds, the pricing. It's just really designed, which is why people love it. And the reason I was talking about Kroger is that there was aspects of them where they were sort of waking back up to the fact that you got to design love into 2,700 Krogers. How do you do that? If people are buying balloons and they roll into the store at 7 a.m. in the morning, and you're the biggest florist, by the way, in the country, which they are.
Wow.
So it's a billion-dollar business. How do you not think about what's the guest thinking when they walk in to buy balloons at 7 a.m. on a Saturday morning because they've got a graduation that night or a birthday that night and they're late and they're frantic because they've probably got to buy cupcakes and streamers as well or a bunch of other stuff. When you walk in, the labor model means that there's nobody there. There's nobody there to sell them balloons. You'd rather they ordered online before. Really, you'd rather they ordered late night the night before rather than coming in, talking to an associate who might then direct them to go buy other things, who might then say, hey, look, it's going to take me 20 minutes to blow up these balloons. Maybe you want to go shop for 20 minutes in my store. Like,
yeah.
If you don't think about the guest walking into the play you're putting on when they're buying balloons, you end up having a totally incoherent experience for the guest, and you lose money, frankly. Costco is an incredibly profitable business because it knows exactly what play it's trying to put on. When you don't think about it that way, you end up having a really incoherent balloon buying experience for tens of millions of balloon buyers. So it's funny, like love is a highfalutin word, right? We got to be more loving. Right. But actually, you know, you drill down, it turns into, why do we have a labor model that doesn't allow somebody to come in and talk to someone about the balloons they're buying? Because we have millions of people doing that every darn weekend. It's like, oh, you've lost sight of the audience.
Yeah, because the other thing about loving, just think about that in your relationship, it's like, just pick up the dishes, like help your partner, like do the thing you need to do to make life easier for them. All the sort of highfalutin keys to marriage. Like, have you started on that? Simply making like the day easier for the person you're living with.
Yeah. Well, it's like harmony. The second feeling, right? Yeah. On that flow is harmony says in any experience we lean in when it's pretty clear that I know the experience is telling me, or in your case here, that your partner is telling you, I know what you're feeling and I care about it.
Yep.
That's all harmony is. So when somebody goes, I know that you're pissed off the fact that you cooked and now I'm expecting you to clean up the dishes after you. No, I'll do that. So it just puts you in harmony with your partner. And when you're in harmony, the opposite of harmony, of course, is jarring.
Yeah.
And we humans, when we, whether it's dishes or whether it's, yeah, one of the examples in the book was I got to the end of my lease for my Audi. I had an Audi,
yeah.
And I got to the end of my lease and I was excited. My feeling was excitement. I was about to come to the end of my lease and I could pick a new car. And it might have been an Audi because I like Audis. And I got 3 weeks before my lease ended, I got a robocall from some part of Audi. Some playwright at Audi had decided that what I should get is a robocall where the person said, you as a clearly not a human voice going, you have failed to schedule your termination inspection. And when I hear that, it's not awful. It's just, I go, I failed. So I'm excited. Dopamine is, and I'm now met with Audi going, hey, you failed to schedule your termination inspection. And all I do emotionally as a human is I might not even have the words for this, but it's like, oh, clearly Audi hasn't thought about what I'm feeling, or they've thought about it and they don't care because they've hit me with, you failed.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just lean out just a little, and then I lean out just a little more when they ping me again with the same message the next week. And then I lean out just a little more the third week. And then you've lost me for 5 years, Audi. Just that little thing of just going, you're now disharmonious. You are out of sync with me. And so when we think about what you're talking about, you're really talking about just getting it clear to your partner or your customer or your employee, I know what you're feeling and I care. Wherever I might want to move you to, because I might want to move you from grumpy, if you're a grumpy customer, I might want to move you to happy. But I can't move you unless I can meet you. I've got to meet you to move you. And so for any company or any leader thinking about how do we get people, customers to lean into us, how do we get employees to lean into us, you got to meet them in the emotional sense of, I know what you're feeling and I care about it. Anything you can do, the tone of the email, the way you start that meeting, that conversation on the phone, anything you can do to communicate to me that you know what I'm feeling and you care, it's like, it's elixir for us humans.
I love the fact that the idea in my head right now is Fortune 1000 companies employing the best playwrights in the world to work for them. Like if Audi had just hired Tom Stoppard 25 years ago, they would not have had this problem.
Well, it's funny. I do think that storytelling, sequencing, how do you get humans to lean into the point where they go, I love that. You can't hurry love, right? So you got to get them there. How do you get someone to go, I love that? Well, they're the best playwrights. They know from sequence. They know from story. Yeah. Narrative coherence. It's like leaders, if we're not careful, we get a bunch of extractive, process-oriented folks in leadership positions. And yet the overall outcome we're trying to get, if you think about it, the two most powerful questions you should ask yourself as a leader in business is, do we have more customers in love with us tomorrow than today? And do we have more people loving working here tomorrow than today? Not every decision will drive those things, but those are the two big questions. And if you think those are the orienting questions, well, you back it almost immediately. You go, well, what's the journey or what's the story? What's the sequence that gets someone from the beginning of an experience to the point where they're walking around with love in their hearts? How'd you get them there? That's really, particularly in the world of AI, story structure. What is the right sequence, Kroger, for balloon selling? Oh, you haven't ever thought about that? Well, then you've got a whole bunch of guests who are making their own stories up.
Yeah,
we're story makers. You put touch points in front of us and we'll make a story of it. And if it's not designed that the story that that's what you want to tell, we're telling ourselves a story anyway. It's like, hey, dear leaders, the issue isn't, are you an experience maker or not? The issue is, are you a skilled one? The issue isn't, are you a storyteller or not? The issue is, are you a skilled one? And when we humans bump into stories that lead us in, at some point we go, I love that. And when you don't, we just lean out and we're not accessible to you. And you don't get the loyalty. You don't get the productivity. You don't get the advocacy.
The book is called Design Love In, How to Unleash the Most Powerful Force in Business. I recommend this book to everyone. And there's a bunch of really terrific stuff on leadership specifically that we didn't get to that people should look at. Marcus, thank you for coming on the show.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Kelly.
Getting DS And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Emma Smith and Colleen Fahey. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.